Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tiewald. I'm your host for this morning, and joining me today is
Peter R.H.
And we've got a bunch of stuff lined up for you today. We're going to start off with an interview with Dr. Andy Hira, a professor of political science here at Simon Fraser University, about the current state of renewables and how they're poised to take a much bigger role in our energy markets here in Canada and around the world, and a bigger role in supplying the energy we need. We also have a report on the brand new First Nations Gathering House that has been under construction here at SFU for the past several years and is finally opening up. Our reporter Danny Nesvadarani was out there last week to check out the big opening ceremonies and find out more about what we'll be seeing from the First Nations Gathering House. We have Gardening with Embark, as we always do in the second half hour. And what are you going to be talking about today, Peter?
I'm going to be following up on the interview. What's this person's name again?
Dr. Andy Hira. Anil Hira, yeah.
I saw you by accident on the bus on Wednesday, so you mentioned this was going to be on, and in email or whatever it was, I heard this will be the third time I've heard the interview.
Mm-hmm.
I got a few things to say about it. Kind of the follow-up on it. Well, one thing I'm just going to interject before we get started here, because I hear the show previous to ours coming up on the bus and so on. And one thing about their last segment about this person wants to be in the race for the leadership of the federal NDP.
Yeah.
I think they've really removed themselves from any grassroots, because $100,000 to be part of the campaign, and he was talking about how they even do other blockades. I mean, and now they don't have the federal NDP do not have the party status,
official party status. Yes,
I mean, what? I mean, I think that's really wrong. I think they should really think to themselves, why are we gone so far away from that? And one thing I heard a few months ago, one of them was saying, oh, it's a lower price than what the federal Liberals would be.
I think the Liberals were $350,000.
But still, it's like, if two wrongs don't make a right, smaller wrongs aren't made right by larger wrongs. So that's just a thing I would add to it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So renewable, we talked a bit about new renewable energies last week, and in many ways there's been a lot of developments happening in the renewable energy area in recent years. Improvements in the direct technology itself and its efficiency, particularly around solar energy. But one of the big things that's always been a limitation for many renewables, particularly solar and wind power, which is what we'll mostly be talking about today. Of course, hydropower is also a renewable energy source, which has been around basically since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and is a very mature technology. But one of the things that has always been a challenge for things like solar and wind power is that the potential to generate the energy is not continuous. You generate solar power when the sun is out and more on a sunny day than a cloudy day. You generate wind power when the wind is blowing, and certainly you can find spots where there is a lot of wind and most of the time, but it's not continuous, and often it's not necessarily happening at the exact same time you need the most power. One of the big changes that's been happening over recent years is the development of battery technology. driven by the drive towards electric vehicles, but really applicable in so many situations. And that's created an opportunity where these power sources can be generated when the energy is available, whether it's the sun or the wind, and then stored in batteries at a cost-effective rate until it's actually needed. And this and other technologies and just the advancement of technologies and costs coming down has really changed the prospect for these energy sources as a part of as a major part of our energy options. I talked to Dr. Andy here. He's part. He's a professor here at Simon Fraser's Department of Political Science, and he's also a part of a group here that's cross-discipline group here that specifically studies clean energy options. And we talked on Friday about where things are going with renewable energies. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Andy Hira. You're a professor of political science here at Simon Fraser University. And one of your areas of specialty or specialization is around energy policy and renewables in particular. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Sure. I run the Clean Energy Research Group here at SFU. And we run monthly research talks as well as produce research policy papers. And so we have our eyes very closely on the very dynamic scenarios and unfolding changes around the energy sector.
Right. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today was that energy is a huge part of our economy and essential to the running of our modern economies. And for better or worse, it's become a very politicized area of discussion. You know, I hear a lot about the oil industry, what they have to say about themselves, what their critics have to say about, you know, different renewables and the prospects for them. And a lot of that conversation can often be quite partisan. So you hear this, you hear that. It's hard to know where things really stand, you know, in the energy sector. We're at a pretty critical point in our history with climate change and the impacts that fossil fuels have had on the environment to this point. But we're also at a point where a lot of the alternative technologies are really seemingly coming into maturity as genuine options. So what is sort of at the moment the prospects for renewable energy as a viable alternative and replacement for fossil fuels?
Well, I think the start of your question is really important because there is just an incredible level of misinformation by the public. And that is directly reflective of the immense power of the fossil fuel lobby, mm-hmm. Both in Canada and in North America in general. In fact, just before we started this conversation, I was starting to examine some of the lobbying efforts of the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. Yeah. And they are by far the most powerful and the most generous donors to the political scene. And so it's not really any mistake that there is such a level of disinformation about climate change. In fact, what we see from more objective analyses are two real important developments. Mm-hmm. The first is what we call the levelized cost of energy. This is an average cost for building new plants. And what we see for the first time is, not even including all the costs of pollution and climate change, right, that onshore wind is competitive with natural gas. This is a game changer because we all have noticed how coal has disappeared from the scene because natural gas was cheaper. And now onshore wind is competitive with natural gas. The main challenge for renewable energy is its intermittency. The mm-hmm. wind is not always blowing, so you have to include the cost of batteries. But even including the cost of batteries, onshore wind in many locations is now competitive with natural gas. So it really shows you that we're at a turning point, both in regard to EVs and in terms of renewable energy in general. Solar is still more expensive. However, solar is modular, so mm-hmm. it can be done on a small scale, yeah, incrementally. It doesn't require huge utilities. And so solar will probably play a major role in the future just in terms of adding to our energy grid. And we need to add to it because we all know from AI and cryptocurrency and just general demand curves that it's going to vastly outstrip our electricity supply.
Right. And solar, like wind power, is intermittent, but it is likewise benefiting from the development in battery technology.
It's moving fast. We're still not at the point of having batteries with long enough range to ease the anxiety of EV purchasers. But in fact, everyone knows that, you know, more than 90% of our trips are well within an EV range. It's just when you get to the long distance trips that it becomes a problem. And the real problem is that, you know, we have monopoly utilities in Canada and they're unwilling to privatize the EV charging space. Right. So we just don't have enough chargers.
So how scalable are wind and solar and other renewable options to rise up, bring that energy generation up to the level that's currently provided through existing technologies, but particularly fossil fuels?
You know, people see it as a black and white question, but it's really not. In fact, there are red states in the U.S., like Iowa, like Texas, that are getting 20% of their power from wind right now. And California is getting a substantial amount. I can't remember the exact number, but it's in the double digits of solar energy plugged into its grid. So what you're going to see in this transition period is an increasing level of contribution from renewables while oil and gas start to be phased out.
So as we move forward, and the economic argument for further development in renewables and solar and wind and also geothermal as an option. On the one hand, that seems very promising. On the other hand, the oil industry already receives huge amounts of subsidies in various forms. What factors are those going to play? Is it going to be enough that there's a good business argument to move this forward or not?
There is not a business argument for it. In fact, we just released a Canadian scorecard on fossil fuels last week. And anyone can access it on the CERG website. Mm-hmm. And what they'll find is, in fact, as renewable energies become more competitive, if you start to include all the losses to the economy of climate change, just think about all the wildfires across Canada.
Yep.
Think about the town of Lytton burning down. Mm-hmm. Think about all the effects of mountain pine beetle on our forestry sector. Think about the effects on our food security. And then when we start to talk about sea level rises, that's just going to damage infrastructure in any low-lying area in Canada. And so when you start to add up those billions of dollars of accumulating damage in climate change, there really is no justification for the federal government and the BC government approving new LNG ports and investing public money potentially into pipelines and certainly into LNG. In fact, it's a losing bet. The International Energy Agency and any number of energy analysts predict that there's going to be an oil and natural gas glut. So we're putting money into these new infrastructure projects based on public money, and we're never going to get paid out for it because the oil market is going to collapse in 10 to 15 years.
So taking in all those costs that you just mentioned and the impacts, the argument seems unrefutable. But at the same time, the way a lot of our economy works, especially when we want private companies to be investing, and they're not subject to all those costs. So how does that affect that business argument? I think one of the things that, you know, the oil lobby has done is effectively prevent themselves from being responsible for all those kinds of costs in one way or another. So how do we, you know, how do we move forward with a business case to make sure this happens when a lot of the people making investment decisions in respect to their own companies don't need to worry about these other costs?
It's a classic case of what we call the innovator's dilemma.
Yeah.
You know, AT&T was one of the pioneers in cell phone technology. Never invested in it. Mm-hmm. Xerox developed the mouse technology, never really invested it or developed it. So how can we expect the energy companies of today to undercut their own business?
Yeah.
It really requires forward-looking public policy to say, you know, just like we built the interprovincial highway system, just like we built our hydroelectricity system here that's given us, you know, over 96% of our electricity in clean form, we have to think about new national projects that develop these clean energy industries. Right. So I wrote an op-ed last month in The Conversation called It's Time for an East-West Grid. You could eliminate all fossil fuels within Canada within a couple months by linking up the different grids across the provinces because we have abundant hydro, geothermal, wind, solar. And if you start to connect all those together, Ontario wouldn't need to use, and Atlantic Canada wouldn't need to use fossil fuels anymore. That would be a project that would create thousands of jobs.
So what would it take for that to happen? I mean, I know the government is now making up lists of big projects that they want to fast track to boost the Canadian economy. Does something like this need to be one of them?
It needs to be one of them because it requires interprovincial cooperation. Mm-hmm. And so the federal government is the only one that can pull this off. And the more important thing is Alberta is going to avoid any kind of transition, which means by the mid-2030s, the economy will collapse. Mm-hmm. So the federal government really should be talking about setting up clean energy projects in Alberta. There's abundant geothermal, wind, solar there. We have critical strategic minerals. We could develop battery plants. We need to have these new jobs developed by the federal government so that people will start to let go of the old jobs rather than just being in a free fall.
Right. So it sounds to me like, I mean, what we know now is that wind power is viable competitor to fossil fuels. Solar power is very close to that. I know I've talked to you before about geothermal and its potential. But it's going to take some serious government policy and action to push this transition.
Yeah, geothermal is a perfect example of it. In California, even in Indonesia and the Philippines, beyond Iceland, geothermal is very well developed, provides a huge boost to the electricity system, provides hot water and heat. But in BC, we don't have a proper policy framework. You need to have a policy framework that reduces the upfront risks of exploration and drilling of geothermal.
Right.
And we have all these abandoned oil and gas wells across Alberta. You know, the government could provide some sort of insurance or guarantee, and the private sector would do the work.
Do you see, I mean, we all know it's necessary, this transition away from fossil fuels. We've been talking about it for 30 plus years. And in many ways, not making a lot of progress. I think we're using more fossil fuels today than we ever have before. So how do we? What is the prospect for this transition? I mean, the economic argument seems to be being made and being possible now, but there's still a lot of barriers.
Look, the markets, we believe in market economies, and the mm-hmm. market should be allowed to dictate without interference in them. Ironically, this is an argument I wouldn't have made 5 or 10 years ago when renewable prices were a lot higher.
Yeah.
But right now, renewables are competitive. So the government should invest in these large infrastructure projects, and then it should stop supporting fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pour more money into fossil fuels. And what you'll see over time is renewables will start to hold their own. And as they get adopted, just like EVs, the prices will come down. And they're going to outcompete fossil fuels. So Canada is really late to the party. What we're seeing in terms of the projections about oil and gas are based on the fact that renewables are competitive and that EVs are becoming increasingly competitive. And that's why Canada should be investing in those industries and not industries that are going to disappear in 10 to 15 years.
Right. So based on what you know now, where do you see us in, say, 15 years on this question?
Really, a lot depends on political leadership. You know, right now, our political systems are geared toward 3 to 5 year cycles. And what we need is a 20-year vision for where the Canadian economy wants to be. And if we don't hop on that bus while the window's open to us, then we're still going to be stuck as secondary suppliers of commodities. Take one small example, Denmark, a country much smaller than us, one of the leaders in wind energy because they got in early. And obviously we all know about the spectacular success of Ozempic, supporting a lot of the Danish economy. It's because they were first to the market with that drug. So if Canada sits on its hands and tries to keep, you know, milking this fossil fuel cow for the next decade or so, then we're just going to be lost in terms of the race for clean energy.
Right. And I guess what you're talking about is all the other spin-offs that come from developing this technology and being a leader who can then export this to other countries and trading partners.
Exactly. It's the reverse of the innovator's dilemma in the sense that if you are the first to market, then you have all this built-in learning curve. You're allowed to make mistakes. If you think about the, you know, early Macs or, you know, all of the spectacular failures that Steve Jobs had, it was because he was the first to market and he was able to develop a learning curve within Apple and develop the resources and the culture within the company. And Canada can do the same. But if you're second or third to market, you know, you're really at a major disadvantage.
All right. Well, I mean, on the one hand, it's very encouraging that these technologies are coming to maturity. It's a little more worrisome that there is yet a lot of resistance.
Well, my sincere hope is by informing the public, we can start to turn that around.
Right.
Politicians always respond to public opinion. Right now, public opinion is enmeshed, or, you know, there's sort of a matador effect with Trump's tariffs. But that will dissipate. You're seeing already the U.S. economy is hitting, you know, rocky shores because of this tariff policy, because of the doubling down on oil and gas. And, you know, what's ironic is when you look at every other oil producer in the world, such as Saudi Arabia, such as UAE, such as Norway, they're all using that money to diversify their economies.
Yeah.
Canada is the only one that thinks that we're going to continue to do the same as we have for the last 100 years.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Dr. Andy Hira, professor of political science and leader of the Clean Energy Institute.
Clean Energy Research Group.
Research group here at SFU, and you can easily Google that to find out more about that. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and we have monthly meetings. They're all open to the public, and they're hybrid, so we welcome public input and participation in the meetings.
And that's the Clean Energy Research?
Clean Energy Research Group, and
yep.
the events are listed on their website, and people can contact me for further details.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, and I will get that address from you and post it on our website when we post this up on the site. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
All right, thank you.
That was Dr. Anil or Andy Hira, professor of political science here at SFU. We'll be posting this program up on the CJSF website this afternoon, and I'll include a link to the Clean Energy Research Group. You can find out more about that and their monthly meetings that you're open to participate in. We'll be returning to the topic of clean and renewable energies at the end of the show with Peter.
Yes, I'm going to. Few other comments. This is the third time I heard it. Maybe next week I'm going to check up that thing he was talking about, an inter-Canadian link up, which I kind of the first two times I heard it, I did obviously hear it, but I'm maybe going to check that up exactly what he's talking about.
I think what he's referring to is the idea of linking up the electrical grid all the way across Canada, because they're, to a certain extent, each province sort of has its own grid. BC and BC Hydro has its own thing. And I think part of what he's trying to get at there, what he is getting at there, is the idea that if we had one electrical grid linked across the country, those parts of the country that are particularly rich in hydropower, which is a clean and renewable energy, you can talk about the fact that you got to flood valleys and stuff, so it's not like it comes with no cost, but is nevertheless a clean and renewable energy. You could eliminate a lot of the power, other ways of generating power by supplying power from those hydro rich areas.
Well, his statement was that you wouldn't have any fossil fuel.
Well, you wouldn't need them, not to generate electrical power, because you would just provide energy from where it's available. Anyway, we'll be returning to the topic again. If you want to comment on anything you hear here on CJSF on Speak Up, you can call or text us in the studio. We have a screen up here that will get us your text message right away, and we'd love to hear from you. That number is 778-782-2573 or 778-782-CJSF. Like I say, we're going to be, if you have a comment on that interview we just heard, send us a message there, 778-782-2573, and we may include it in our conversation at the end of the program. That'll start at about approximately 10:50 or so, a little before after that time. All right. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up. And we're going to take a little visit to Birdnote, and then we'll be back with our report on the brand new First Nations Gathering House here at SFU.
This is Birdnote. Today is the autumnal equinox, when the sun crosses the equator and day and night are of approximately equal length across the globe. In her poem, Utsuroi, writer Lee Ann Rorapaa reflects on how, as the days grow shorter, the remaining light feels that much more beautiful. Here's an excerpt from that poem.
The band of light that wraps around each day like a wide, bright ribbon is shrinking, the way a favorite shirt shrinks in the dryer, leaving the day's wrists and hips uncovered. A red-headed woodpecker runs up, then down a wooden column on my front porch with splayed, agile feet. Periodically, it stops to tap, head a thrumming, shiny blur like a sewing machine bobbin. The cats nudge the curtains aside with their heads and stare. Things quicken. Why do I always love the light the most, only at the moment of its leaving?
For Birdnote, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, so you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On September 12th, the First People's Gathering House on Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus opened its doors to the public. First announced in September of 2020, the First People's Gathering House has been discussed as a ceremonial longhouse that will serve to celebrate Indigenous knowledge and culture at SFU. The Gathering House represents the four host nations whose unceded traditional lands SFU Burnaby was built on: the Musqueam Nation, the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, the Squamish Nation, and the Coquitlam Nation. Before the opening ceremony, CJSF was able to get an inside look of the First People's Gathering House, where we spent time in the building's Great Hall. The space has very intentionally been wrapped inside and out with cedar, a traditional longhouse building material. While looking through the space, we were able to speak with Alden Yellowhorn, an SFU professor with the Department of Indigenous Studies and a member of the building committee for the First People's Gathering House. While the plans for this building are only several years old, according to Yellowhorn, its creation has been talked about since his time at SFU in the 1990s.
Prior to this, the Indigenous community didn't really have much of a footprint here on campus. And this building really stands in stark contrast to that brutalist style of architecture that is, you know, very part of Arthur Erickson's design. And this creates kind of an architectural dialogue between the very organic ideas of this space and the concrete and edged corners of the rest of the university.
Yellowhorn then went on to describe more of the architectural intentions of the First People's Gathering House.
The way we designed the place with the architect, you know, taking the traditional or the vernacular architecture of local First Nations and using that as the template for creating the physical structure so that even somebody walking past here, it takes like 2 minutes to walk past here, but they'll learn something about First Nations people in that time. So we designed it. Everything is designed to highlight the local culture from the interior design, but also the landscape. We used native plants to do the landscaping, and kind of really emphasizing local area, the local area and what it means, like the place Lukluk-Waitin, the place of arbutus trees. And so we're looking, even if you look at the outside of the building, it's designed to look like arbutus trees, the bark of arbutus trees, you know, and as the building ages, it'll take on that resemblance more.
Lastly, we asked Eldon Yellowhorn what the community response and interest have been so far for the first piece.